Blog Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up the world, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. MJ Network will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. I'm your host. This is MJ Network. And we have a blockbuster show today. But before I start, I promised someone that I would say something nice about his business real fast. So for those of you that need grooming for your pets, go to Pampered Paws, 65 North Central Avenue. Complete cage-free environment for your precious pet. Natural shampoos and conditioners and the best pet care in Hartsdale, New York. I promised owner Victor and Bianca that I would do that. It was nice meeting you guys on Thursday. The number is 914-725-6112. And now we have the author of The Silent Victim, Dana Perry, a.k.a. R.G. Belsky, is here. You can change the world in seconds, and result will linger within you for a lifetime. Fear is a powerful weapon when someone uses it against you in order to make you look around every time you know where you're going. You don't even know where you're going. A veil of darkness can cover your eyes, and the sunshine will hide behind them as you try to overcome the past, something in the present, and find some place where the shadows will help you hide from yourself and stop being a silent victim. Good morning. How are you? Oh, God, I got the wrong person.
No, it's me. Hello. Bye, friend.
Oh, yeah, you're
doing
this. Hi, there's somebody listening, and I'm saying, like, who is that? Oh, yeah, now I know who it is. How you doing?
Well, I'm hearing you, and it's sounding good, but I'm saying I hope I can get involved in this conversation, too.
Yeah, it was the weirdest thing on Thursday. My sister-in-law's father passed away, and this young guy, when I came into the bakery, asked me if he could buy me anything I wanted. And I just looked at him. I was like, huh? And he didn't know why I was there, and he just said, you're really cute. I'm going to buy you whatever you wanted. And I felt kind of uncomfortable, and I said, what the heck?
Okay.
So I decided to. So what made you decide, number one, to write under a different name, and number two, I read in your notes, what inspired you to write this particular book? This is really good, and Claire Carlson better watch out, seriously. She's got competition here.
Yeah, well, the first question is kind of in terms of, so, you know, just so people know, obviously, mm-hmm. My name is, well, it's R.G. Belsky, which I've written a number of books under,
yes.
including the Claire Carlson series that we've talked about. And this book is involves a character called Jesse Tucker, and it's written under the pen name of Dana Perry. And the reasons, you know, get very complicated and not terribly interesting, but it has to do with, you know, marketing and authors. And
mm-hmm.
the bottom line is I was producing a book a year on Claire Carlson, and I had this other book that I had written, and I wanted to get it out there. And a big publisher, actually located in London called Bookature, said, well, we'd love to do this, but we'll put it under a pen name so people won't get confused with your other stuff. And it's available everywhere online, everywhere in Audible, it's called The Silent Victim. And, you know, what this book is about basically is – as you know, I've covered an awful lot of crimes over the years as a journalist. That was the New York Post, New York Daily News, NBC, and all the big, you know, crimes from Son of Sam to the Central Park Jogger to Bernie Getz to, you know, Casey Anthony, all this stuff, OJ. And I sort of became intrigued with the idea of the crime victim and telling the story of a victim, because we're generally telling it from the story of, you know, people writing about the victim. And so I wanted to get someone who, a character who would be like a high-profile crime victim, and then sort of became a media celebrity because of this. And that's what really happens to my character, Jesse Tucker. So 12 years ago, she's attacked in New York City, brutally beaten up, left for dead, and somehow survives. And so she gets a tremendous amount of media attention for this. You know, she winds up writing a book about it and a lot of other stuff and all the stuff that happens in today's society. But she then chooses to go ahead and write about crimes about other people and becomes a journalist. So that was the kind of premise that I started up, because again, I've covered so many victims, and there's a lot of this is sort of inspired obviously by the Central Park jogger case with a woman who was nearly killed. And I was always interested in the idea of, you could fictionalize, well, what happens to that victim, you know, after the crime? And and that's really what the Silent Victim is about. And so she basically winds up trying to solve other crimes, and in the process, as you know from reading the book, she actually comes across all sorts of secrets about her own crime that had never been revealed before.
I know, that was really scary, but she's really tough. I like her.
I think she's, you know, people always say, well, you know, I mean, she's like Clark Carlson character, and they're both female journalists, but I do think they're different in different ways. I mean, they have different jobs. I mean, Claire is a news director at a TV station. Jesse is a newspaper reporter. But you know, Jesse, I think, is more I mean, she's tough, but she's also very vulnerable because of everything she's been through to get where she is today.
I know, and she's very tough, and I like her. That's why. I better watch out, people. You don't want to mess with this one. That's for sure. So, I you know, like you said, this came from the news and the joggers and stuff like that, the Central Park jogger and everybody. This is a horrific experience. And the stories that haunt her in her head, why does someone, you know, get attacked or something like that and decide not to say something about it? Like, she didn't want to say anything, and yet they're haunted in her head. So why would somebody just, like, not say anything? She said,
well,
but
she didn't know. I mean, basically, she was a normal working person. She works for an advertising agency in New York, and she's walking home one day, and she gets brutally attacked, and everyone assumes, including her, it's a random attack. And in fact, a young guy is arrested. He confesses. He goes to prison. He eventually dies in prison. So it seems to be a very simple, wrapped up case. The kind of things we read about all the time now, you know, like some horrific crime happens and somebody's arrested and there's no real reason for it. It's just somebody out to either rob somebody or rape somebody or for no reason at all. For 12 years, she assumes that's the case, and she lives her life like, okay, this was a terrible thing, but it happened. There was no reason for it. And then in my book, Present Day, she suddenly begins to realize that there was a reason for it and that nobody has ever really found the reason or determined who did it or exactly why. Mm. So she basically winds up, you know, investigating her own case again. And this all comes about because she's assigned to cover a similar attack in Central Park. Mm. But while she's covering that, she suddenly realizes, well, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense about this case, but then it also doesn't make sense about my case. So she then goes, you know, which, you know, I think we all love cold cases. She basically then goes back and decides to reopen her own case and start all over again. And the answers she comes up with are not anything close to the answers she was told at the time by everybody when it happens. And I mean, we're talking about the police, the DA, the politicians. Everybody had told her a story. In many cases, they believed it too. Some of them did, and so did she. So it really opens up a Pandora's box of all sorts of tangled stuff for her.
Yeah, it does. She's a really good, I like her though. I can't wait to see if you're going to ever put Claire Carlson and Jesse in the same book. That would be interesting.
Well, you know, people have asked me, because, you know, before this, I wrote a series of four books involving a male reporter, Gil Malloy, who worked at the New York Daily News. And people have said that to me too. That, well, you know, can you have Gil Malloy meet Claire Carlson? Would they have how would they get along?
Yeah.
Would they have a romance? You know, my thought is that they probably either get married or kill each other or both, you know,
yeah,
because they're both kind
yeah.
of, you know, you know, I mean, yeah, they could sort of say the same thing. Would Claire and Jesse Tucker get along? I'm one of those people, in reading other people's books, and I don't like when people do that, and, you know, someone, and like, I am the biggest Michael Connelly fan in the world. I've read every one of Michael Connelly's books. I think he's maybe the greatest writer we have current around writing mysteries. But I don't like it in his books when he has, like, one character meet the other. Like, you know, so he'll have the lawyer now, you know, relating to Bosch because they're, you know, they're half-brothers. But at various times he's had the newspaper guy. He has the interconnecting characters. And whenever it does, it kind of jolts me a little because I suddenly realize, oh, wait, this is fiction. So I've never done that in a book, and I don't know that I ever will, but who knows?
That's okay. I can deal with that. This way I get to read two different people and two different novels. I don't have to worry about it. Then I
right.
have to sit and figure out
under
what's happening.
Under two different names. There you go.
That's right.
It's very confusing.
Confused.
Yeah, we're already. I'm already confused, and I'm confusing other people. I think this book, you know, just stands alone on its own. And again, this was originally written as a standalone book that Jesse Tucker was going to solve her own crime as well as the other, and that would be the end of it. But you know, there's now going to be another one coming out in June. We've talked about this, and still working on the title. But so she's going to, you know, continue on, you know, covering crimes because the reaction has been, you know, has been good for her. So she's a separate character from Claire Carlson.
I have to tell you, this is hilarious, because when I saw you advertise this, it said the silent victim, Dana Perry. I didn't know it was you.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know me. I get in trouble every single day when I say, okay, this, I have to read this one. I like this one. Somebody's got to send it to me. And I wind up getting the book without even asking for it, which is even better. So
yeah.
Jesse has two bosses, Isaac and Danny. How are they different? And she, yeah, I know, they're very different. And she's a lot like me, because if I want to know something, I'm going to push you to the limit until I get what I want. So
yeah.
She's just like that, which I really could identify. She's like Claire, but she's even more like me. So tell us about Isaac and Danny. And then we'll get to somebody that reminds me of my own mother. Seriously.
Yeah, there's yeah, one of the things that I always enjoy doing, because pretty much all my books are written in media settings, because that's what I know, New York newsrooms, and so this is set in a fictional New York City newspaper, and she has a city editor named Norman Isaacs, who's like been around forever and is like an older guy, and very set in his ways. And they have a young guy who's very who's very ambitious, Danny Knowlton, who kind of wants the other guy's jobs, and so this creates kind of a lot of tension in the newsroom, and puts Claire. I'm sorry, there you go. I just did it. It puts Jesse in the middle, and Jesse. So Jesse basically likes working with Danny because Danny's very aggressive and ambitious and wants to push on stories because he's trying to get ahead. But he also, she's not sure she can trust him because he's out for himself. So when she really needs something, she goes to the older Isaac's character because, you know, he brings a stability. So working this, and, you know, this is something that, I mean, I have done in newsrooms, and I'm sure everybody who's worked in any capacity has probably done in their job, which is you see the people that you work for and you kind of use them in the best way you can. You know, sometimes certain people are good for certain things, but you want to go to somebody else and you kind of got to balance it off. And so a good deal of the book is really involves Jesse trying to navigate these political waters of the newsroom, because you know, it helps her do the story if she can use both of them. And so I had a lot of fun writing. I had a lot of fun writing those two characters. And like all my characters, they're not based on actual people. But I've known a few Danny and a few Isaacs in my life in the newsroom.
See, it pays to do what you did because you have more resources than the rest of the world. That's good. So the other character, I wasn't crazy about her, was her mother. How does her mother's treatment of her as a child still control her now, and why?
Yeah.
I know how that feels.
Yeah, that's a, you know, I think you have to, you know, the mother is not a huge part of the book, but she's out there because,
yeah.
like all of our mothers, there may be a bit of my mother in there and your mother, and it's like I wanted to describe somehow, you know, where Jesse had come from, and her mother was a kind of a big part of her life in both good and bad ways, and the culmination comes where the mother basically wants Jesse to be perfect in everything, and when Jesse is beaten up and left for dead and is in the hospital in Central Park, the mother really isn't there for her. Her first words to Jesse when she wakes up is, why would you do something so stupid like that, like go into, and get yourself, almost killed like that, because suddenly Jesse isn't perfect anymore. So she has a very complicated relationship with the mother, and she never knew her father. And, again, the book isn't about that. I mean, the book is really a thriller and a mystery, and it's about the story. But, with most books, you need a bit of backstory to kind of describe why the character is like she is today. And between the mother and the everything that happened to her in the park, that's kind of why Jesse is as tough as she is. She's also very fragile, and she has had trouble, maintaining relationships with men, and she's very defensive and cautious about, showing her emotions to people. So that's just it's a part of the character. But that's a tough portrayal to make of the mother. And I think, as you said, I think when we write about somebody's mother, we're always writing about not only people we know, but probably in some elements of her. I mean, that wasn't my mother, but there are some elements of that in there.
I agree, because every time I don't look perfectly great or I do something that I'm not sure is perfect, I could say, okay, Mom, doing it over. I got you.
Well,
hear her in my head. It's horrible.
Yeah, and I suppose if a mother or a father was seriously terrible and abusive or something, that's sort of simple to understand. Oh, they're just a terrible person. But generally, it's not like that. Generally, it's a complicated bag. Like, on one hand, they kind of envelop you in love, and on the other hand, they tear you down in different ways. And that's I know so many people with parents like that, and that's kind of what I tried to do. And that relationship between her and her mother, and the fact that she never knew her father, that actually becomes a much bigger part of the second book that'll be out in June, because she winds up pursuing that on a different case, a different story. It's interesting, but again, you don't want to bog the book down with a whole psychological thing on her, but you also want people to understand the character and why she does some of the things she does. I throw in here one of my favorite things about talking about the character, which is the one thing you have to do when you're creating a character like this with Jesse or Claire or any of them is they gotta have problems, because they can't be
of course.
Perfect. And because if you had a perfect character, that character would be really boring. I've told the story at a couple, you and I have met at a couple conferences like Thrillerville, and I've told the story because one of the best things I ever heard about that was from Reed Farrell Coleman, who, of course, until recently was writing the Jesse Stone series that took over for Robert Parker. And he was saying this thing about how Jesse Stone is one of the most difficult characters to write, and the reason being, that he's so perfect. I mean, everything about the character. I mean, he's good looking, he's tough, he's honest, and he looks like Tom Selleck, because when you read the books, you're thinking of Tom Selleck in the TV movies. And so the trick is you have to bring flaws to him. So like, Reed had said, he has a drinking problem. We know that. Okay. He has a marital problem. He broke up with his wife. He has an issue that he was going to be a baseball player, but he was hurt, and his ambition was thwarted. So, that's what you really need to do with any character, because you want the reader to get annoyed sometimes at the character, get mad at the character, but ultimately to, have affection for the character.
Luckily, what happened in the book I finished yesterday, you won't hate the main character and hope they get killed off. No, seriously. No,
well,
I'm serious.
You know,
I won't even tell you what it was. The main character was really a nasty, arrogant guy, so you get to like him and respect him, but the rest of the characters, I was very glad that they killed off a few. Didn't even bother me.
The basic rule, I think, in writing a character, mm-hmm. beyond what I just said, is there are no rules, because the other classic example is Gone Girl, and which I, a lot of people have mixed feelings, but it was hugely successful, and I thought it was terrific, and I thought the characters were both fascinating, not the movie so much, but the book by Gillian Flynn,
mm-hmm.
and those are, those characters, both of them are incredibly unlikable characters, and right to the end of the book, there's nothing in there that makes you want to like them, and yet the characters work. So the key is, if you write a character that can, get emotion out of people, you can kind of break the rules even sometimes. But most of the time, when we read a character, when we read, Harry Bosch or Kinsey Malone or
mm-hmm.
any of the people that we've we love over the years, there are people that we like. We like them. You want to spend time with them. That's the other thing when I'm writing. Like I'll say, I want people to say, the best compliment people say is, I'd really like to spend time with Jesse Tucker or Claire Carlson. They're the kind of person I'd love to be around. Because if you can create that, then I think you're going to be successful.
Well, let's talk about Margaret Kincaid. She gets called to investigate the murder of Margaret Kincaid. And they arrested Joseph Enrico as a man suspected, but she doesn't know if they have the right guy. So the most interesting part was listening to Margaret on her phone. She was agitated, refused a taxi service, walked into the park. So how did they play into her mind with her own case? I mean, why in heaven's names, if somebody is agitated and afraid, would you not take a taxi service or offer help? And the guy offered to help her out, the guy there in the restaurant.
Yeah,
I
well,
mean, that
it
was
gets,
an interesting
yeah,
scene.
It, yeah, to simplify, for people who obviously haven't read the book yet, basically, the Margaret Kincaid case is the one that sets her off on sets Jesse off on her own case. So, in other words, 12 years ago, she became famous for surviving this attack in Central Park. Now, today, another woman, Margaret Kincaid, who was working for a senator as a campaign aide, is attacked and left and killed in Central Park, not unlike what happened to Jesse, although Jesse survived. So Jesse is assigned the story, or does the story, because it makes sense. Like, I'm going to write a story about another woman like myself. And and that's what starts it off. That woman is Margaret Kincaid, although we find out later she isn't necessarily Margaret Kincaid because there's all sorts of secrets. But it appears on the face of it to be just like Jesse's case, a very cut-and-dried case. All the police say, they arrested somebody, he was shot and killed in a shootout, he had the dead woman's belongings with her. So it's cut and dry. There's no real story there other than she died and they killed somebody. But Jesse begins asking some of the questions that you just asked. Well, wait a minute, this woman's movements don't make sense. Why was she walking in the park? She left a restaurant.
Yeah.
She was arguing with somebody. She could have gotten in a cab, but what was she doing? And then eventually Jesse realizes she went into the woods because she was trying to meet somebody there. But who, and so that envelops the whole thing. And then we find out, the whole backstory of this woman who is Margaret Kincaid, but it turns out she's also a whole other person with her own backstory. And so basically Jesse winds up working two stories at the same time. She's working the Margaret Kincaid story, but eventually she starts looking back on her own story too, because of questions she's found in the Margaret Kincaid. But they also kind of move on a parallel thing. And she actually becomes convinced that whoever attacked her 12 years ago also attack Margaret Kincaid now, even though everybody says she's crazy because the person that attacked her is dead. So it's playing around with the two cases 12 years apart is really the thrust of the story in The Silent Victim.
Yeah, well, you people have to read it. I don't know where everybody is, but there are people listening. But I have to tell you, You guys got to read this book. It's really good, seriously. And unfortunately for the people that asked me to read it, I told them to go on Amazon because I'm not giving it away. You got to get it yourself.
So just so people know, Bookature is a huge online distributor in America here. I mean, they're in England, but they have a big presence here. So, yeah, all you have to do is go on Amazon and it's really, by the way, it's because it's just an online, basically it's online, it's really cheap. It's it's $2.99 right now. And, $2.99. And that's it. You just click on, you know, the Kindle thing, and it's on your iPad or your Kindle or whatever. And there's also an Audible version, which is really cool. I love hearing somebody, you know, read my words. That's always good. And there are print versions, but it's not really a print. You know, I know you got one, but it's not really sold in bookstores. So the best way to get it is just go online for $2.99 or you know, get the Audible version. You know, whatever Audible situation you have, but it's really easy to get.
I'm so glad I have the print version. It made life so much easier for me to sit on my chair and relax and put my feet up and read.
I used to feel that way, Fran.
I still do.
I'm like a traditionalist, but you know what changed me is because I travel a lot now. You know, going to conferences and stuff, and I used to drive me crazy because I was always packing books or when I went on vacation, and now I just take my iPad and I got all the books on my iPad. I don't have to pack all those books.
I go to the Thriller Fest. I don't know what I'm doing this year. I haven't decided yet, but when I go to the Thriller Fest, I've got like a half a dozen books in my bag, and then they give you this swag bag, and I'm going like, I'm going to have more.
I live in the city.
Yeah, so you don't have that problem. But I didn't go last year, but the year before, I mean, I wound up going home with like, oh my God, I couldn't even carry them because people were handing them to me, and that made me feel so good.
I'm
in Westchester.
Okay.
I grew up in the South Bronx, and then we moved to another area in the Bronx. And then when my mom died a few years ago, I finally got to move out of the building that I was living in, which was really not exactly safe and wonderful anymore, and had a lot of creatures there, if you know what I mean, that came to visit ever so often that I really didn't need to have visit. So when we moved up here, it's really nice. And I like to get up in the morning early to read. But at 7 o'clock in the morning, you could take a walk, and the bakery's opened. And they're really nice to me, and I get free stuff all the time, so that's even better.
I lived and worked most of my life in the city, but I spent 10 years working for American Media, which was Star Magazine in the heyday of the 90s when we sold and everybody bought it at the supermarket, and that was located in Westchester. It was in Tarrytown, so it was nice. I'd live in the city, and then I'd get to go up there and look out at trees and see deer on the, it's a nice change from New York.
Well, I'm not that far away. From Tarrytown. So who is the real victim that was raped, and how does she get her to speak out? Because she didn't want to speak out.
Well,
she finally gets the person.
I don't want to get too much into the story so what that refers to is, when something happens to Jessie, she's attacked in Central Park, but then she begins to question whether there could have been another victim too, and she eventually is able to track down this victim, and that sort of adds the complications of the story. Because there's this other woman who never had come forward because she had been attacked, and not unlike, I suppose, people who undergo something like that, she did not want to tell anybody, and so she never reported it to the police. She just kind of went home, but now 12 years later, Jesse's able to discuss this with her, and by doing that, Jesse finds out more about her own story, and of course has a tremendous amount of empathy for this other woman who went through something not unlike what Jesse went through. But it just part more of the, I don't say the confusion, but the fact that a simple case is maybe not always a simple case. It has many layers, mm-hmm. and that's kind of what happens in the silent victim. I mean, to me, most of my stories, I think I try and tell like that, which is you start off with a simple premise. You go, okay, well, that's what happened. And then you start to unravel it and go back, and you realize, well, wait a minute, no, that's that. And then you wind up getting a whole different story of what happened. And the woman you're referring to is clearly that woman. And then mm-hmm. the other part of the confusion, and I know this is something else you had asked about, we were talking about, was the confession. So at one point, the woman, the person who supposedly had attacked Jesse, had confessed before he went to prison. And, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
I talk a lot about that because I always find that's an interesting thing about the whole idea of the confession, and when are confessions real confessions, when are they not. And we always see this. I mean, you know, like, even with the Central Park, they were confessions, and they supposedly mm-hmm. were coerced, you know, but there are different levels of coercion. So, I mean, it isn't necessarily, you know, that somebody beats somebody with a rubber hose or flashes, you know, it's not necessarily like that. There's a lot of psychological things that can happen. And the other thing is, what is the person confessing to? So that's kind of could be one of the issues in this book. In other words, if the person commits a crime, like say you I'll use you because you obviously probably have a criminal past. I'm joking, but let's say let's say you go into a house and you steal something. You steal a TV mm-hmm. set or a laptop, and you leave. And then afterward, somebody else goes in the house and kills the person who lived in the house. And mm-hmm. the police bring you in, and they're like, okay, we know you went in the house. We know you're guilty mm-hmm. of this crime. And you start confessing, but you're confessing to one crime, not to the other crime. That also is something, is what's happening in this book, because there's several mm-hmm. crimes going on. And so what is the person confessing to? And the other thing with confessions, which you always see, which is true too, is that then you have all the people who confess because they want attention. So you have mm-hmm. I mean, how many people have confessed to killing John F. Kennedy or confessed
yeah,
to,
I know.
To burying Jimmy Hoffa, you know, because people come forward and they come up with false confessions, and sometimes they're just crazy, sometimes they just want attention.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually devote like one whole chapter in this book to kind of looking at this whole thing of confessions and false confessions. But again, it's more interesting to me, not that, you know, some law enforcement officer beats a confession out of somebody like
yeah.
they might have done in the 40s. What's more interesting is that somebody is smart enough or has enough sophistication that they can get a person to say something that they want
That's
them
right.
to say. And the police officer, too, may not be he may not have a bad motive in this. He really believes that the person did it. And that's what happens a lot in this book. The law enforcement believes this person did it. They just want to get him convicted. So they'll do what it takes to
mm-hmm.
to get that thing. But they're not trying to railroad an innocent man. They believe this is the person, but they need to get the evidence. And you know, one of the things, this is something I actually learned from reading a lot of Michael Conley, and I love doing it too, which is that law enforcement in general, with DAs, police, whatever, you start with a premise and you build evidence
mm-hmm.
to back up that premise. If you find evidence that takes you in a different direction, you're more likely to disregard that. You go, oh, well, I don't need that because
mm-hmm.
that's not where
yeah.
I'm going. But if you start out back at square one and you follow the evidence, it might take you in a different direction. And that's just – it's not like people are bad or wrong. It's just that's human nature, and we all do it. We assume something is true, and then we look for everything we can to back that premise up, and we ignore everything that we don't like. If you like a politician, you ignore all the bad things about him and focus on the good things or whatever. So that plays a big role in the book too.
I agree, because a lot of people aren't open-minded. And then there's me. If I'm not sure, I mean, I can't tell you how many mystery thrillers I've read. Too many, probably.
You've read a lot, yeah.
I, you know, it's funny because sometimes I figure it out, and sometimes I figure it out on the first page. I go, oh, God, why am I going to torture myself a little bit longer? And then sometimes I actually don't finish the book and tell the person, I can't read this. This is, like, killing me. And
but not every book has to be. Not every book has to be a surprise. I mean, you can read a good, you can have a good mystery where you kind of. I mean, I always use the example. I mean, it's not a book, but it's the classic mystery. I always use the example of you know, Columbo. I mean, can you imagine pitching a TV series? You pitch a TV show. So we got this thing. There's nobody in it but this one guy, and he's kind of disheveled. And we know who did it at the beginning of the hour and a half, and then he spends the next hour and a half proving it. We're like, well, that sounds boring, right? You know, it sounds terrible, you know. And yet it's one of the greatest mysteries ever because you're not waiting to find out who did it. You know who did it. You just want to
see
the process.
That's right. How's he going to figure out to get him to say he did it? Yeah.
Yeah. So I just like I said, I go back to when I was talking about Gone Girl and characters. I mean, one of the things that I've begun to believe after reading a lot of mysteries over the years, and like you, I've read them for a lot of years before I started writing them and then writing a lot, is I mean, there are some rules, and a lot of the rules are good, but in the end, you know, you can have a really good mystery that breaks every rule. And in fact, sometimes when that happens, it's actually refreshing because you're like, oh, wait a minute, I've read 90 books like this, but I never read anything like this book.
That's true. This is true, and you should see the ones in front of me. I have like about 30 books staring at me of people I have to interview. And then there's 20 on my chair that I'm looking at like, oh, my God. No, I just got a few that are really interesting that I've never read them before. There's a new author, Douglas Bentley, Without Sanction.
Mm-hmm.
Is that Donald Bentley? Yeah, it's interesting. And I got one by Charles Finch. I never read him before, also The Last Passenger.
Yeah, there's so many. There's so it's so hard to.
I don't
so
know where I got these two, and they're interesting. But
don't you think? I was just gonna say, you think that? I know I find that with all these books, and we were talking about stories and everything, but I find to me that the character trumps everything because, like, if it's not a particularly good story, but the character's good, I'll read the book. It can be a really good story if I'm not. If I find the character boring, I don't read it. So.
Yeah, I know. So speaking of boring, I haven't decided. Right, they sent me a business book to read. That's not me. And I specifically asked the publicist, I said, I love you very much. I've helped you out before. You got the wrong person. Don't worry. You're the only person that's going to get it right. This book is 600 pages.
Oh,
and the last three business books I read were like, you know, How to Get Rich Like Warren Buffett or Bill Gates.
Yeah.
And I didn't read the book. I refused to review them because I knew it was a bunch of baloney. And this one, my nephew was an investment banker, so I said, Josh, you're going to help me out if I need help? Because I said, you can read it in 5 minutes. He says, most of that stuff is, you know, whatever. So it's in my pile on the bottom of 20. I don't know if I'm going to get to it ever.
Well, I always operate on the theory with all that stuff, you know, how to win at poker, how to get rich. You know, I always operate on how to win at the racetrack. But I always operate on the theory that if somebody really knew the answers, the last thing in the world they're going to be doing is telling everybody else, you know.
Yeah, I know.
Just going to do it and get rich, you know.
So.
Like, why would you tell everybody else here? So I don't, I take that all with a... but there's a limit to what we can all, how much we can all read, and obviously you have to do a tremendous amount of it, but to some
degree
you have to limit it, yeah.
Jesse meets Logan Kincaid, haha, and then she gets herself in hot water with the police and everything. So how does her relationship with him help her or hinder her? And then she gets in hot water with the investigation, and she wants her own case reopened, and they're not happy with her at all.
Right. So Logan Kincaid, and you know, if that Kincaid sounds familiar, it's because the original name of the victim was Margaret Kincaid.
Yeah.
So Logan Kincaid emerges at some point because Margaret Kincaid turns out to be not Margaret Kincaid. The Margaret Kincaid turns out to be somebody who is now dead. And so the brother like comes to Jesse in the hopes that he can find out more about his sister, who's not the woman in the park. So leading from that, he starts getting involved with her in the story because he's looking for answers too. And this leads to a romance, and Jesse really hasn't had a whole lot of romantic life. So they begin to, you know, bond as not just friends, but with a romantic thing. So, yeah, he becomes like the romantic interest for her as this is going on. In terms of the investigators and all the people, again, it goes back to what I said about people. The original people investigating the case were not out to do wrong. They were not out to put the wrong man in jail. They all did what they thought was the best at the time. And Jesse became friends with a lot, and she became best friends with the police, the detective who handled her case. She becomes best friends with the mayor who used all his political influence to help her with stuff. So it becomes difficult, though, because when she goes back and discovers there were mistakes in the case and there were things that they did that weren't exactly right, you know, she then has to go back to these people who not only are her friends, but she's very grateful to for all they did for her. And this is tough for them because, like with the police detective, by uncovering her own story and saying, wait a minute, this didn't happen the way you said it did, it kind of makes him look bad. And in fact, the whole police department has this, you know, we've got all these live cases going on. Why are you trying to reopen a case that we solved 12 years ago? So there's a lot of resistance. And it's the kind of resistance I think that anybody would normally do. If you've done something and you're successful at it, and then many years later, somebody said, "Well, I don't think you did that right." And you're like, you know, just go away. I don't want to hear that now. You know, it's done. It's over. Mm-hmm. Let's just move on. So Jesse's the only one that can't just move on because it involves her. So she winds up ruffling a lot of feathers of people who are people she likes, people she cares about, and again, in most cases, are not people who were out to do anything maliciously wrong. We're doing their job, but in the end, they made mistakes along the way. So it gets very uncomfortable for Jesse in terms of dealing with them.
Before I forget, and I want to forget, this is going to be interesting on Thursday, people. Montague Fault is the title of the book, and I'm interviewing three authors at the same time that wrote the book. This is going to be fun. It's three novellas, three teenagers that did something wrong, and it's going to be fun doing that. And on Monday, we have award-winning author Talia Connor, the third daughter. On the 16th, we have an author that I don't know why she's not out there more, Mary E. Martin, The Wondrous Apothecary, the Alexander Wainwright series. It's absolutely phenomenal. And on the 17th, the one and only Philip Margolin. Margolin, Reasonable Doubt. Yes, he asked for the interview, and I am totally flattered, seriously. And on the 31st to end March, Susan Hunter and Dangerous Ground. It's absolutely, it's really good. And so far, these books for next month and yours, of course, on the 27th, are really, really interesting. So how does Iraq come into this? We have Lansdale and Rico and other victims' father. How does it come back to the fact that they were in Iraq? How did you tie that in? Because that was interesting.
Before I get to that, I just wanted to say, when you're going through those other names, I was actually had the opportunity to be with Philip Margolin on one of your shows a while back.
He's
on
great.
The panel.
Yeah.
And I think I told him at the time. I think one of the early books he wrote, Gone But Not Forgotten, is one of the best serial killer books I've ever read. When I was writing a serial killer in the 90s, I mean, I read that book this is the kind of book I want to write, you know. He's somebody really like an interesting, real interesting person. Iraq, there's a whole, without getting into the story, there's a whole war thing going on. When I originally wrote this book, I mean, I tend to write books over a long period of years, so some books I'll sit down and write, now because I have a contract for them, but I've also written a lot of books over the years and put them aside or use portions of them in another book and things like that. That's just kind of the way I work. And originally, actually, I was, because I'm actually old enough that I was in Vietnam, originally I had the war background in Vietnam, but then at some point, you know, like with the Harry Bosch books, you know, the timeline doesn't work. So I changed it to Iraq in the 90s, you know, the first, trying to remember now which one it is. But anyway, so I set it in Iraq, and the war stuff plays a big part in this book, the sort of the B story, and there's a whole background thing involving the war and involving some of the characters and their actions during the war that become relevant now to Jesse. I know that sounds kind of vague, but if I'm too much more specific, then you give away, you know, the plot, because so much of this book is like you uncover things, and some of the things you uncover you think are significant and some aren't. And, you know, so that's what I try and do. And so the question is the Iraq stuff significant? And Jesse certainly believes it is. But, you know, that it's one of a number of elements of things that are going on in the past that lead to, you know, what has happened to her and what has happened to this new victim. So.
Okay. Now, before we end, let's see, Jesse probes and the police want her to stop, so they put pressure on her. So tell us about the investigation, interrogation questions, and they think that they can get a confession. But why do they want to stop her? They want to literally stop her.
Well, at one point, she becomes convinced that a major political figure is involved in the attack on her and also the attack on the current person. And she becomes quite aggressive toward this person, confronting the person in public and creating a scene. So when someone attempts to assassinate this political figure, kill this political figure, Jesse becomes an actual suspect. She's able to get out of it relatively easily because, I mean, it's not terribly likely she's going to go out with a gun and do something, but there is a period where, you know, the police are looking for something, and she's already antagonized the police by doing what she's doing. So they kind of just decide, well, we're gonna look at her as a suspect. So they bring her in, they pick her up, they interrogate her. And I actually really like this scene in the book because the point is, because Jesse is a crime writer and understands all the interrogation procedures of the police, she's not intimidated by it. And in fact, she throws it back at them because she knows like maybe there's somebody behind a window watching her. She knows this. She knows what they can do. She knows what they can't do. And this, of course, just annoys the police even more because she's not intimidated when they bring her in. And she's basically like, you know, do what you're going to do. But don't waste my time, and they have to let her go and look elsewhere. But I actually really enjoyed writing that scene because there's a whole chapter where she kind of turns the tables on the police interrogators and basically outsmarts them.
That's why I like the book, because she's a female character that doesn't act like an idiot and gets it done. I read so many of them, and they go like, you know, I'm seriously telling me that she did this or that character did that, and go like, that's when I skip to the end of the book. And
the other thing about the character, which we haven't talked about, which is a big part of the book too, is that she did not escape unscathed from TAG 12 years ago. So she had a lot of injuries. She had to go to a tremendous amount of rehab. At one point, nobody thought she'd ever walk again. She still sometimes has a bit of a limp, has to use a cane. But the one thing she has to do is she needs to work out physically all the time just to keep her body working because of all the damage it suffered. So she's 36 years old, but, you know, her body is not in good shape for a 36-year-old because everything she went through. So that physical thing, and it becomes a thing in the book. I think there's a couple points in the book where she'll actually use it to her advantage. Like she'll kind of pretend to stumble, like she can't
walk.
Yeah, I know. To get sympathy or something from somebody. So she's not above doing that, but she clearly also has a lot of, you know, you don't totally recover from something like this. She's not crippled, but she's not 100% either.
Well, I knew that. I wasn't sure if you wanted to tell too much about her, but she realizes some harsh realities, and she has trust issues, and she has to adjust the way she proceeds a lot of times. So that's kind of hard, too. And, you know, after something like that happens to her or someone else, you sort of, even if they catch the killer, you sort of look over your shoulder, like, is this going to happen again? I don't advise that people go into Central Park at night by themselves. They've had other incidents there. It's sad. In the world, I mean, I just watching the news this morning, and they're still having incidents in Newburgh and everywhere else, and the different communities. It's horrible. So Jesse learns who the killer is, and the motive is just plain. We won't say what. So
right.
How do you weave this quality so intricately in the plot, and how does the killer's identity stay hidden? And I'm going like, really?
Well,
this is the first one I said, oh, my God, you got to be kidding me. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Well, it's, you know, I actually am not sure. So in any book that you write, any mystery writer writes, you have a number of characters and you have a number of possible suspects. And sometimes you know from the very beginning who it is. And other times as you're going, you go, wow, what if I made this person the killer in the end, you know, or this person did it, and of course you then get into the, you know, you get into the whole red herring business, because, you know, there are people in this book who really she zeroes in on as like a suspect, but if that person does it, then and it's as simple as that, then it's like, okay, well, I saw that coming. So, you know, there's a lot of things going on in this book. There's a lot of people with guilt. There's more than one guilty. There's one very guilty person, but there's other people that are carrying guilt too. So one of the fun things as an author to do is to figure that out. And like I said, I've done it two ways. I've done it where I know exactly who it was, and in this case, this is a character who is in the book, and but is not necessarily. I don't think the ending is an obvious one, and but at the same time, you have to set it up, because you can't. You know, it's like the old thing. You can't just out of left field, you know. Bring in somebody and say, oh, that person did it. You have to drop clues. You know, the key to it is if somebody is surprised and they go back and read the book and they go, oh, I should have seen that. Look, oh, when she said that, of course, that's what she meant. You know, so that gets that can get a little tricky. I actually really like the outcome of this book. And again, there's a lot of guilt to go around in this book. A lot of the characters have secrets, and things come out that they're not really, necessarily the best people in the world. But the end result, again, is that Jessie basically has been carrying this burden for 12 years, even though she might not have realized. She thought it was over, but she's still having nightmares. Well, now she's finally reached some sort of closure in this, and it's kind of helped her life, not just in terms of getting justice for that, but also having her get a better view of herself as a person and kind of moving forward from there. So all those elements, you know, are things that, you know, I worked really hard to get into this book. And I like all my books, but I actually really liked this book, and I was very, very happy with it, the story. Yeah.
So before we close...
Let me tell one other thing before we close, because I just want to throw one other
thing.
Oh, yeah,
we've got
time.
I want to know where you're going to go. Where she's going next.
The last scoop, that's what I said. The last scoop came out, it's coming out in May, which is the next Claire Carlson book.
Right.
And it just got a terrific review in Publishers Weekly, which is captivating and all sorts of other stuff. So if you like the Claire Carlson books, the last scoop will be out in, and I'll be back talking about that, you know, then, but it comes out on May 5th, which I think is the day I'll be back here. And then there'll be another Jesse Tucker in June. And just so everybody knows, I don't write these things back to back. Some of these have been written earlier, but they're all going to be coming out in a series. So.
No, I'm excited because, you know, it's May 5th, and that's the day of the interview for this particular book. And I'm not going to tell you if I got the ending. I was like, oh, my God, this was really good. Seriously. The Last Scoop. The Last Scoop.
The Last Scoop, yeah.
You know,
my
review's coming out on May 5th. Nobody's seen it before, but I have to tell you, it's one of my brilliant ones, let me tell you.
Okay. Yes. Well, again, that's good when people get to the end and they go, oh, wow, that was, you know, that was... Because, look, there's a lot to the book beside the ending, but the ending is what you're left with. So you want it to be... You want it to be something memorable. So, as I'm one of those people, a lot of authors are. You know, I basically don't have trouble with beginnings of books, and I generally am pretty good with the endings of books. It's those middles that are those are the toughest to write because you got a long way to go, you know, to get there. So, you know.
Claire needs a boyfriend, though, somebody she can depend on. She's having
She's got a lot
fun,
of them.
I'm sorry.
She's been married three times.
I know, especially the married guy. I mean, really.
Yeah, but it doesn't work if you put her with somebody. You know, it's like TV shows.
It doesn't,
you
know. I
know. Yeah.
She's cool. So where can we learn more about you and your work? And you just gave me an idea for a panel show, by the way.
Oh, great. I'm in.
this, you're going to definitely be in. It's How Do You Choose the Killer of Your Novel?
I've done
villains, you know, blah, blah, blah. I've done the main characters, but I've never done how do you decide in a book that you've decided on one killer, how do you choose a different one? How do you choose the person that's actually guilty?
That'd be a really good topic. And I know, like myself, and other people too. You can change your mind along the way. Decide. Oh, I thought that was going to be the killer, but no, I think I'll do this instead. Anyway, people can read all about me at my website, which is www.rgbelsky.com, and I also have author pages on Facebook as Dana Perry, Writing the Silent Victim, Dana Perry, just like it sounds, Dana Perry, and also as R.G. Belsky. So, you know, you can check out either of them. But my website generally has most of the updated stuff, and of course can tell you where to order stuff.
So thank you so much. It's
Fran, it's always
outside.
A pleasure. It is. It's I'm sitting here by my in Manhattan looking out at a nice day, yeah.
It's 52 degrees. Actually, I went out this morning to just take a walk and get air when it was only 30. I was brave.
Yeah.
Today it's going to be up to 55. Tomorrow, I forget, it's going to be cold again. By the end of the week when I get hair and nails done in the Bronx, it's going to be freezing again. And I get to go into the Bronx. I go in at 6:30 in the morning, seriously.
Right.
Well, so have a great day, everybody. It's beautiful
outside.
Take a walk. Thanks, RG. I am so excited. I will talk to you again.
And thank you. Thank you for everything, Fran. I always appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Everybody have a great day, and bye.